Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Halper.
I'm Mary Matte. Hey, everybody. Our website, which you're especially going to need now, given the era we're about to re-enter, is usefulidiotspodcast.com. Go there to support the show and keep us going. And we'll need to keep going because guess what, everybody? In case you haven't heard, we have another 4 years ahead of Donald J. Trump. Yes, the guy who tried to launch a riot when he lost last time. The guy who's been found liable for sexual harassment and, you know, other misdeeds is walking back into the White House. And he can thank, I think, a really inept Democratic rival for that. And that's definitely what we're here to make fun of.
You can count on us for that during these next 4 years. So the president may change, but something that isn't changing is our show. So let's start off with the four basic food groups. Aaron, what do we got for Democrats?
For Democrats suck. Let's look at how the most reliable Democratic Party stenographers are handling this defeat, where Trump not only won the presidency, but Republicans retained control of the Senate. And as of right now, it looks like they're favored to retain control of the House, although votes are still being counted. And so how did MSNBC's Joy Reid respond to all this? Well, when she looks at the Kamala Harris campaign, she has nothing to criticize. This is Joy Reid.
Let's just be clear. And nothing that was true yesterday about how flawlessly this campaign was run is not true now. I mean, this really was an historic, flawlessly run campaign. She had Queen Latifah never endorses anyone. She came out and endorsed. You know, I mean, she had every prominent celebrity voice. She had the Taylor Swifties to the Swifties. She had the Beehive. Like, you could not have run a better campaign in that short period of time. And I think that's still true.
So we're going to judge a presidential campaign now, not on whether, you know, they won and not on whether they spoke to issues and reached people, but on how many celebrity endorsements they get. Like, especially given that celebrities generally go Democratic anyway. And I don't think, like, Queen Latifah, you know, I love Queen Latifah, but I don't think there was ever a chance she would endorse Donald Trump or any other Republican. So I don't see how it's a big achievement that Kamala Harris managed to get Queen Latifah's endorsement along with Taylor Swift and Beyonce. And it's like, I mean, you're really going to say that Kamala Harris ran a flawless campaign, not only because she lost, but because there are so many things to criticize. And we're going to just go through over a few of them. Here's a nugget from The Atlantic magazine, which, you know, very close to Democrats. And they report that Kamala Harris initially started out, you know, going after, you know, the ultra wealthy, but then dropped that. And this is the reason why, according to The Atlantic. While Harris was stuck defending the Biden economy and hobbled by lingering anger over inflation, attacking big business allowed her to go on the offense. Then, quite suddenly, this strain of populism disappeared. One Biden aide says that Harris steered away from such hard-edged messaging at the urging of her brother-in-law, Tony West, Uber's chief legal officer. To win the support of CEOs, Harris jettisoned a strong argument that deflected attention from one of her weakest issues. Instead, the campaign elevated Mark Cuban as one of its chief surrogates, the very sort of rich guy she had recently attacked. So according to The Atlantic, Kamala Harris started out sounding like a populist, but then because her brother-in-law, who happens to work for Uber, you know, one of like the biggest corporations in the country and one of the corporations that is like represents the so-called gig economy in which workers have no rights and are essentially at the mercy of a phone app that, you know, dictates their schedule and that dictates their, you know, that takes away their wages because Uber famously does not pay a driver's, you know, a decent percentage of their earnings. Because of that, she abandoned populist rhetoric, and yet people want us to believe that she ran a flawless campaign.
That is so disgusting, that story about her brother-in-law. I mean, the Democrats totally deserved to lose. Kamala Harris absolutely deserved to lose. The problem is that she takes the rest of the country with her. So now the country has to be subjected to 4 years of Trump. Not that 4 years of Kamala was going to be a lot better. I mean, that's up for debate. But I mean, that is just so unforgivable. so unforgivable.
Yeah. And what was Trump's major accomplishment in his first term? It was a tax cut that favored the ultra wealthy. Some people who watch the show disagree with me on that. They feel as if they benefited from that. Granted, I'm not an economist, but I don't know. I trust the economists who say that tax bill from Trump benefited the ultra wealthy, but we can debate that some other time. The point is that message was lacking from Kamala Harris's messaging. And instead, she was palling around with Mark Cuban and the Cheneys and not appealing really to working class people. And there's also, of course, and this has been the main topic of our show for the last year, is the genocide in Gaza, which Kamala Harris refused to distance herself from. When she became the nominee, she said, "I will not be silent about Gaza," but she was silent about Gaza. She did nothing to distinguish herself from Joe Biden on that. And then accordingly, that gave Trump, who's a massive Israel supporter, who's funded by, you know, the most like fanatic Israel supporters, people like Miriam Adelson, that gave him the lane to pretend as if he cared about peace in Gaza. And so look, for example, at what the Republicans did in Michigan, where there's a heavy Arab American and Muslim American vote. And they took advantage of Kamala Harris's stance on Gaza. And this is one of the flyers that they were distributing to people in Michigan. This is what it said. "For peace, vote Trump. No new wars, family values, affordable groceries." And then there's a photograph of Kamala Harris in front of the rubble in Gaza. And it says, "We did it, Joe. We did it." So that's Trump taking advantage of Kamala Harris's unfettered support for genocide and tying that also, you know, very smartly to grocery prices, because these wars that the Democrats have become synonymous with are costly, not just in Gaza, not just in Palestine, where they've spent tens of billions of dollars arming Israel, but also in Ukraine, where they've also spent tens of billions of dollars, you know, fueling a proxy war. And Trump has basically pretended to be anti-war to appeal to people who are outraged by these travesties. And I think it helped him win.
Speaking of Queen Latifah, it's really too bad that, remember her song UNITY?
Sure.
She couldn't achieve that around for Kamala Harris.
Yeah, well, again, I mean, the lesson here is like, as wonderful as all these celebrities are, you know, celebrities are not the pathway to victory. I think we can learn that by now. Hillary Clinton had a similar thing in 2016. Like, there are all these celebs endorsing Hillary, you know.
On that song, "This Is My Fight" song.
Like Tim Kaine and the Membrane. Who could forget that from Lin-Manuel Miranda? Didn't work out also in 2024.
Well, you can always count on the Democrats to not learn the lessons.
And that's why Democrats suck.
For Republicans suck, as Aaron just mentioned, Trump likes to present himself as the anti-war candidate, as the president who's going to drain the swamp. Unfortunately, that doesn't look like that's true. So Brian Hook, who served under Donald Trump and George W. Bush, is reportedly getting the call to start staffing the State Department for a new Trump term. He was also the head of the Iran Action Group in Pompeo's State Department. And to get a sense of his politics and just how anti-war he is, here he is speaking in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
A recent poll shows that a plurality of the American people believe that President Biden has not been aggressive enough in his dealings with Iran. I believe that Iran knows that it can safely expand its axis of resistance because of the Biden administration's deep aversion to defensive military action. The Biden administration de-escalates to de-escalate. The Iranian regime thrives under this strategy. American troops do not. They have been attacked 165 times by Iranian proxies since October, and the United States has responded 11 times. This imbalance is untenable.
So there you have it. There's the anti-war administration for you.
Yeah. Brian Hook is like a key architect of Trump's so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran, which in real life means maximum sadism against Iranian civilians, because that's who the sanctions that the U.S. imposes really hurts. And so now he's staffing up the State Department for Donald Trump does not bode well for Trump's claim to be anti-war. And but look, you know, it doesn't take much to see that this was, you know, another scam on Trump's part. This is what he also pulled in 2016. He campaigned as being anti-war. But then as soon as he got to office, he surrounded himself with neocons. And it's funny, you know, I've spoken to some people who were part of the Trump campaign in 2016, and they were just like, as soon as, you know, some of them expected, and they basically adopted like a very like libertarian anti-war point of view, like the sort of Rand Paul faction of the Republican Party. But as soon as Trump won, they just got froze out, you know, and they felt betrayed. And, you know, safe bet that Trump will continue that tradition, especially if he's appointing someone like Brian Hook to help staff up his State Department.
But, you know, again, like the Democrats definitely made it easy for him to call out their hypocrisy and claim to be the anti-war guy. So congrats, Ems, on that. What do we have for Isn't That Weird?
For Isn't That Weird, let's, you know, do more of a postmortem here and look at Bernie Sanders, what he is saying. Now, Bernie Sanders is going to make a critique about the Democratic Party. But this critique from Bernie Sanders also raises questions about Bernie Sanders and whether he could have done more to avoid this loss, this humiliating loss that we just saw from Democrats. So this is Bernie's take on Kamala Harris's loss. This is what he said. It should come as no great surprise that a Democratic Party, which has abandoned working class people, would find that the working class has abandoned them. While the Democratic leadership defends the status quo, the American people are angry and want change. And they're right. So fair enough, Bernie. Totally fair. But then, you know, what's weird here and what I think raises questions about, you know, Bernie's choices is like, why didn't Bernie say this more vocally earlier? And why did he, you know, basically claim that the Biden administration was fighting on behalf of the working class? This is him just recently speaking to Meet the Press.
I believe that President Biden in many ways has been the most progressive, pro-worker president since FDR.
So he called Biden the most, you know, progressive, pro-worker president since FDR. And maybe technically that's true. But if it is true, it's only because everyone else has been so horrible. And so why go out of your way to like heap praise on Biden as some like, you know, progressive champion when he hasn't been that? Why then did Bernie maybe not be more vocal about this earlier and even run himself? Like, why cede to Biden and then to Kamala Harris if he feels, as he's just saying, now that they've abandoned the working class? And this is a point that Brianna Joy Gray made. This is what she said. Then why didn't you run yourself or support a change candidate? What's the point of being an independent if you spend your political capital manufacturing a consent for candidates who you apparently don't even believe in? I mean, fair questions. I mean, to be fair to Bernie, what would his response be is that, you know, he's already run twice. The nominee was Joe Biden. He was the incumbent. And then Kamala Harris was going to be the nominee and there wasn't going to be a primary process. But then the counter argument there is why not call for a primary process? I don't know. But it's just feels like with Bernie, it's like too little too late. And maybe if he'd been more vocal with his critique about Democrats abandoning the working class, they could have avoided this abandonment at the polls on election day.
I don't think they would have listened to him. I don't think there was anything he could have done, but except for run himself or endorse someone else.
Yeah. Well, I think that's key here is we, you know, progressives have to be looking to who's next, you know, because Bernie obviously he's passing the baton, but to who, you know, who can have the charisma and the appeal to, you know, appeal beyond just progressives. To appeal to the working class people that went for Trump. That's the challenge ahead.
So for Isn't That Terrible, we have a terrible story about Kamala Harris. So Mint Press is reporting that on Election Day, footage surfaced showing her at DNC headquarters appearing to speak with voters on the phone. At one point, she held up her phone to display her engagement, only to inadvertently reveal the camera app was open instead, suggesting she wasn't actually on a call. Let's take a look at the video.
Have you voted already?
Give me a second.
Please. You did. Thank you.
So there she is saying, have you voted already? You did. Thank you. Thank you very much. Now, maybe it's because of that voter outreach that she lost. Maybe the whole time she thought she was calling people to get out the vote, she was just on her camera.
Now, the thing is, we have to be careful here. Sometimes, you know, on phones, like you can have another app open while still being on the phone. So it was possible in the background of the camera app, there was the phone on as well. We have to, you know, because we're serious journalists here. We have to be, you know, careful. But the problem is Kamala Harris is so like bereft of any like, conviction on anything. Like she has no real, you know, values, it seems like, or at least like that's the widespread impression of her. It's just easier to believe that she was talking to a fake person on the phone just because, you know, like, remember, there's a reason why she didn't win a single delegate back when she ran for president in 2020. And this time was untested in a primary. Is she just, you know, for at least for me, she exudes phoniness, like a lack of real conviction. You know, not that Trump is any better, but it's just and Trump certainly, you know, so many times Trump has been caught like pretending, like when he pretended to get the news about the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Remember that clip where he's coming out and he's like he's pretending as if he doesn't already know, and then the reporters tell him, he's like, that's terrible, you know. So
terrible. Quite a woman.
Anyway, Kamala Harris pretending, it looks like, to speak to a voter, kind of an illustration of her campaign, pretending to care about real people's concerns but not offering them anything.
It's a perfect metaphor, but as you say, we do want to leave the possibility open that she just had the camera app open as well, but either way she's terrible, so it works no matter what. All right, those have been your four basic food groups. Since this is a podcast, you can only hear me right now, but if you could see me, you'd be saying, whoa, who is that? It's me, Katie Helper. I'm just wearing the new fashion line from American Giant. Since 2011, they've been making high-quality, long-lasting, timeless American clothes, including their classic full zip, which was named the greatest hoodie ever made by Slate Magazine. Right now, I'm wearing the very stylish moto dress, perfect for feeling sporty and sleek, made with their soft and stretchy French terry fabric, and Aaron got the roughneck chore jacket, so he's looking good throughout his endlessly busy schedule. From activewear to work fits to the latest fashion picks, American Giant has it all. When most apparel companies have shipped too much overseas, making cheap disposable clothes and creating complicated global supply chains, American Giant stands for simple, local, high-quality goods. It's the kind of difference you'll feel and appreciate for years to come. When you buy American Giant, you create local jobs in towns that help stitch communities together. Get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use the code USEFUL at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code USEFUL. As you know far too well from listening to Useful Idiots, the 2024 election is coming fast. And while we can't predict for sure which candidate will win, we do know that either way, everyone else in the world will lose. Unless there was a fun and easy way to make a little extra cash on the whole terrible contest. That's right, betting's not just for sports fans anymore. Now it's the political junkies' time to shine. We figured that if we spend all our time on Twitter anyway, following the election and endless political analysis, why not put our knowledge to the test? It's MyBookie, a new sports book that lets you bet on the 2024 election from the general election down to who will win each state. If the world is crashing anyway, why not cash in? Don't miss out on this. Pick a side. Use promo code USEFUL to double your first deposit and instantly start with a leg up. Only with MyBookie. We are really excited to be talking to Youssef Munayyer, who is head of Palestine-Israel Program and senior fellow at Arab Center, Washington, D.C. He also serves as a member of the editorial committee of the Journal of Palestine Studies.
And Youssef is a close watcher not only of the genocide in Gaza, but also of domestic politics in the U.S. And so we're going to hear from him, you know, how Gaza factored into the election and also how Democrats dropped the ball, not just on genocide, but other issues as well. And, you know, let Trump claim the mantle once again, as he did in 2016, of being an anti-war working class champion, and how he rode that con to get another victory. So here is Youssef Munayyer.
Thank you so much for joining us, Youssef.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So we want to start off by asking probably what is on everyone's mind right now, which is how and why did Trump win the election?
Yeah, so I mean, with any time you have tens of millions of votes cast, there's not going to be any one single reason. But there's going to be some reasons that I think are more important than others. And because of the way our very bizarre political system works here in the United States, tens of thousands of votes in some remote corner of a Midwestern state can matter more than tens of millions of votes in the biggest states in the country. I think it was a combination of factors here. One of the big ones is turnout. We saw a record number of people come out to vote in 2020. Joe Biden got something like 81 million votes. Kamala Harris was not able to replicate that. You know, for his part, Donald Trump didn't exactly grow his vote totals from 2020. So the question is, you know, where are the extra 6 to 10 million voters who probably voted for Joe Biden in 2020, didn't vote for Donald Trump this time, but also didn't vote for Kamala Harris? That, I think, is the big picture question, the big picture reason why she didn't end up winning in the key states. Now, in those key states, the differences were fairly small. 100,000 votes made the difference in Wisconsin, in Michigan, in Pennsylvania was something in that range. And if you look at sort of the vote totals and the differences from 2020 to 2024, Trump didn't really tear things up and increase his numbers in those states in a significant way compared to the last time he ran. What happened was fewer people who had voted for Biden came out to vote for Harris. And those differences in very important places, including in Pennsylvania, for example, in Pittsburgh, in Scranton, in Philadelphia, winning those places but not winning them by the same amount ends up losing you the state, right? So, you know, despite the fact that Democrats, you know, their main message was democracy is on the line. This is an existential election. We have to stop Donald Trump. And despite the fact that 81 million people agreed with that message and voted for Democrats in 2020, they couldn't get those same people to come out again and vote for them, right? And so that, I think, is the big picture question. Why did that message fall flat for so many people? And there's probably a range of reasons why. And one of them that I think is really important is, of course, the Biden-Harris administration's continued support for Israel's genocide in Gaza. That's not the only reason that people didn't turn out, but it's an important one. It impacted different constituencies in different ways. For some people, it was just a moral question. You know, there was just no way that they could cast their ballot for someone who could not say that what was happening was wrong, let alone do something about it. And I think for other people, it wasn't necessarily about, you know, anger or frustration over what Israel is doing to Palestinians. But some of the other sort of corollary messages that follow from this Israel policy, right? You know, we heard from the Biden and Harris camp and the Harris campaign, as I noted, this is an existential election, right? And at the same time, we knew that this issue of support for Israel was going to be one that could potentially cost them really significant votes in very important places and potentially throw the election in the direction of Donald Trump. But despite that, they didn't budge an inch on Israel policy. So these two messages were kind of in conflict with each other. How could it be that American democracy is on the line? How could it be that this is an existential election? And yet you're unwilling to even move an inch on support for a genocide thousands of miles away. How is that possible? Right. So there was the question of whether or not these messages were actually seen as legitimate. I think for a lot of other voters, too, and this is not just about Gaza, but about sort of U.S. engagement around the world, they care about bread and butter issues at home. And for a lot of people, the last several years economically have been very difficult, especially with the impact of inflation. And they see government officials who are supposed to represent them, who are supposed to address their concerns, focused on sending billions of dollars to the other side of the world for conflicts that they're not interested in, they don't really understand. And whether you care about Palestinians or don't care about Palestinians, the fact that your government seems to be more concerned with issues thousands of miles away than the issues that impact you at home reinforces the message that these people don't get me. They don't care about me. And so I think in this variety of different ways, right, U.S. policy towards Israel alienated a lot of people. And I don't think it made those folks vote for Trump. You know, I think it made those folks stay home overwhelmingly. You may have some people that voted third party. You may have some people that switched and voted for Trump. But I think overwhelmingly, people just said, I can't do this. You know, I can't do this. I think that played a very big role in the direction of this election outcome, particularly in these Midwest states, these blue wall states, that Harris really had to have to be able to win this election.
It wasn't just Israel, too. It was also Ukraine, where Democrats have overseen the spending of well over $100 billion to fuel that war as well. And it barely got discussed. Like, Kamala Harris didn't mention it that many times. When she did, she defended Biden's policy. And then there was that famous moment where she was on The View and she's asked, you know, would she do anything differently from Biden? She said no. She couldn't identify a single thing. And in fact, she took credit for essentially all of his policies, making them indistinguishable. What about the claim from the Biden world and the Harris world that, you know, they did do things domestically? It's just it would have taken more time for Americans to feel the positive impact. So, for example, the legislation they did get passed lowering the price of prescription drugs, the investment they put into, you know, green jobs and factories, that these things, people will actually feel the benefits of them at a certain point, just not immediately. And that failed then to galvanize their voting base.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think we have to be fair about the context as well. The pandemic changed the world and didn't just do that in the United States, right? It changed economies for everybody around the world. There isn't a major economy around the world that hasn't been dealing with massive inflation. And this hits people in their pocketbooks in very direct ways and changes what is possible for them on a day-to-day basis in terms of taking care of their families, right? That's real, and it's happening all over the world. And when you look at the United States in comparison with the rest of the world, there's plenty of evidence that suggests that the United States actually did a pretty good job trying to get inflation under control compared to a lot of other places. But most voters are not sitting down doing a global comparative analysis of macroeconomics, right? They are looking at what the situation is for them and saying, this is not good. This is not right. We need more than this, and we need more than this now. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the person that ends up getting elected because of this is going to fix it, right? It just means that they are indicating their dissatisfaction with their votes. And at the same time, while you do have this overriding context that, of course, is going to make things difficult, I think, for any incumbent in this situation, Democrats didn't do a very good job of reading the room, right? Joe Biden was the most unpopular incumbent in history. I think his approval rating was somewhere around 38%. At one point, maybe it even dipped below that. No incumbent has been able to win under 40% approval. Okay. Harris was in a very unique and strange position because she was from the incumbent administration, but she wasn't the incumbent herself, right? She was running for the office of president while still serving as vice president, and there was a sitting president. So she had to kind of navigate a really difficult challenge of, you know, sending the message that she does offer something different without trashing her own record and her own administration. And yes, this is a tightrope to walk. At the same time, I think they could have done a much better job of it. This was a change election. People wanted something different. Trump absolutely benefited from that. In fact, the last time Trump won an election, it was also against a historically unpopular candidate in 2016. So, you know, when he's been able to win because the other side is really playing with two hands tied behind their back, right? But in this situation, the Democrats had a major opportunity. Yes, Biden was a terribly flawed candidate. He wasn't going to win. He was deeply unpopular. But they had a vice president that was younger, that could speak to a different generation of voters with different concerns.
That could speak in complete sentences also.
And can speak in complete sentences, you know, and could send a different message about the kind of energy and direction and future of the party. But they failed to do that. They had the opportunity, but they failed to do that. And I think that's going to be another one of these big sort of picture reasons for why she was not able to win, is that she couldn't separate herself enough from the unpopular incumbent. You know, one of the ways that she reinforced the perception that she was no different than Joe Biden was that she couldn't talk about the situation in Gaza any differently than Joe Biden. In fact, after repeated opportunities of being asked, hey, what would you do different here? How she went back to the boilerplate language, you know, people just heard more of the same and they didn't want more of the same. That doesn't mean they really wanted Donald Trump, but they knew they didn't want more of the same.
You know, the one thing she did do differently was when Benjamin Netanyahu was visiting the U.S. in July. And, you know, this is around the time when she was just when she just gotten the nomination or she'd been passed the baton by Biden. She said something like, I will not be silent on Gaza, right? But then she was silent because she didn't say anything differently. So maybe that line, I will not be silent, was like them trying to workshop some different approach and seeing how that landed. But whatever it was, she was silent. She didn't say a single thing differently than Biden.
Yeah, they experimented with mixed messages to different communities. And we saw that in some of their advertising strategy in places like Michigan, where they were sending clips of her saying things like, I will not be silent on Gaza, to Arab American voters, and, you know, her talking about how supportive she is to Israel, to Jewish American voters, and other voters who support Israel. But, you know, that wasn't going to cut it. It wasn't going to cut it. Not when you've seen tens of thousands of Palestinians killed, and not when we're seeing a genocide underway, and not when, you know, we're seeing an American government that's fully complicit in this genocide. You know, the shift in language is not going to make up for that. And I think, you know, there were probably many people who, no matter what she did, would never be able to bring themselves to vote for a member of the Biden-Harris administration. But I do think there are probably a lot of people who, if they made meaningful, tangible policy shifts before the election, particularly as it relates to weapon sales to Israel, would have said, you know what? This person understands that something has to change. They're not just sending words out there to try to trick us into supporting them, but they're actually shifting policy. But that's, of course, not something that happened, right? And I think that ended up playing a big role in why they lost the election. And, you know, I think the other thing we should mention is that they shouldn't be supporting a genocide because they shouldn't be supporting the genocide. In fact, if ending your support for a genocide costs you an election, you should still end your support for a genocide. Like this is a moral question before it's a political one, but they failed on both counts,
right,
which I think makes it so much worse.
It's interesting because you pointed out how kind of hypocritical it is to say this is about democracy, this is about an existential threat. Donald Trump is a fascist. So you say that on the one hand. And then on the other hand, there's the data showing that it would be popular for you to change tracks on genocide in Gaza, and you don't do that. So how are people going to believe that you actually care first and foremost about this threat to democracy? But I think that also, so that speaks to people who really care about Palestine or foreign policy in general. But I also think that, you know, something that's not being looked at that you addressed earlier on is just how many people, for various reasons, stayed home. So I definitely think you had people who, because of Palestine, could not vote in good conscience for Harris, and they stayed home. As you pointed out, maybe some voted for Trump, but not that many, and some did third party, but not that many. Although in Michigan, there was a big third party turnout, right? But I also think that people who don't already really, really hate Trump and really, really love the Democrats don't particularly care about the fascism message. I don't think it resonates with people who are concerned about bread and butter issues. And, you know, I think that Nina Turner said this in 2016 when Hillary lost to Trump. She said something along the lines of Bernie Sanders felt people's pain. Donald Trump pretended to feel people's pain. And no one really believed that Hillary felt people's pain. And I think there's a similar thing here where I don't think that Kamala Harris really communicated being in touch with people's pain and people's issues. I wonder if you could speak to that.
I think it, you know, a lot of it is about memory too. American voters overwhelmingly rejected Donald Trump in 2020. And at the time, they had a front row seat to the Trump show for 4 years. Right. They saw exactly what it was like and they decided they didn't want to do this anymore. Right. But one of the most interesting sort of, data points that I saw in the past year leading up to this election is how people remember the Trump years. And actually, people's impression of the Trump years has changed over time. And people have a more positive recollection of the Trump years than they did in 2020. That is something that always seems to happen over time. If you ask people today, for example, how you feel about the Obama years or the Bush years, even though, people rejected Republicans in 2008 with the election of Obama, within a few years after that, they kind of missed George Bush. Right. So people have this way of like forgetting the things that really animated them in passionate ways pretty quickly. The Democrats tried to send this message that like Trump is dangerous. He's going to hurt you. He's going to deport you. And, you know, a lot of people who lived through the Trump years, yeah, they remember the chaos. Yeah, they remember it was pretty crazy. But that message did not have the kind of resonance that it could have because they survived the Trump years, and many people look back at it and think, was it really as bad as they make it out to be, right? Mm-hmm. Or are they just using these words like fascism and dictator and so on and so forth? Don't get me wrong. I think Trump is a very, very dangerous leader. I think he's very, very bad for this country, and I think there are a lot of Americans who are going to suffer under his government. But the Democrats failed to make the case as to why they would be better and stronger than Trump to enough voters that it lost them the election. And I want to go back to this point. Trump did not convince a lot of Biden voters to become Trump voters. Harris failed to convince Biden voters to become Harris voters. Right. And that ended up deciding this election.
And of course, you're not going to hear that introspection from Democrats or the media because it doesn't serve their interest. No one wants to say that that's the reason. They want to pretend it's, you know, because of Trump, I'm kind of shocked by the overt demonization that we're seeing, not just on Twitter, but I mean, we played a clip the other day of Joe Scarborough and Al Sharpton basically saying that it's because Black men are misogynists and Latino voters are racists.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to hear a lot of these sort of exculpatory explanations now. Look, the reality is that campaigns are a business. And there's a lot of people who are going to make money off of campaigns and working in political operations, regardless to the outcomes of the elections. And when you look at the amount of money that went into this election. Money was not the reason that Harris lost this election. In fact, she outspent Trump significantly, outraised Trump significantly. That didn't matter. It also didn't matter for the people who were going to get paid handsomely for the work that they were doing on the campaign. And so, you know, there is a what I would call a campaign industrial complex that's not really interested in introspection, right? They're interested in, obviously, their own interests. And their own industry, and less about what's right or wrong for the American people.
You know, I also hope Democrats reflect on what I think is their over-reliance and I think abusive reliance on the Justice Department to go after Trump. Like, they did it with the whole Russia thing where he was investigated as a Russian agent. That didn't work out. After he leaves office, they relied on all these cases to convict him. And they remember how convinced they were that he was over after he was a convicted felon in the finance case in New York. And, you know, I think some cases had some merit, like especially in Georgia. But there are all these different cases, and that, you know, burnished his self-image as being someone prosecuted by the establishment. And look at it now. Now the Justice Department has just announced they're going to wrap up Jack Smith's cases in time for Trump to take office. So Jack Smith was once presented as this, like, you know, savior figure like Robert Mueller. And look at him now. He's like, his thing is sputtering out. And there's no, and it's like, it created great content for the cable news networks. They loved it. And it created a lot of excitement among the base and the mugshot of Trump in Georgia. But look at it now. I mean, all that's over. And everyone will be forgetting about that. Because if anything, I think ultimately it helped Trump because he could go to his supporters and say, look at them trying to go after me for representing you. It fed into his like self-image as being this outsider targeted by the swamp, even though he's just as much of a swamp creature as them.
Yeah. And he is a convicted felon, right? I mean, that the conviction did actually happen. And I believe that there's sentencing that's going to take place based on that conviction
this month, yeah.
Soon, right? So it'll be interesting to see how that works out. But no, I agree with you. Trump was able to capitalize on the perception that Democrats fed into, that he is some sort of martyr, right? That he is some sort of persecuted martyr that they're trying to get rid of because, you know, this billionaire actually really stands up for the working class people, right? You know, he was able to manipulate that perception in a way that probably convinced a number of people. Right. And to feed a certain narrative of grievance, which is what much of his politics is based on.
What is your argument about why, given the polling that showed a change in policy on Palestine would have been popular? Why did they ignore that? And then what would to play devil's advocate? I mean, we see the benefit of that. Would there have been a cost that would have outweighed the benefit remotely? I mean, I guess being in the crosshairs of AIPAC.
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiotspodcast.com.
Well, thank you again to Yousef Munayyer for joining us. And wow, I just can't believe 4 more years of Donald Trump. Like, we've already went through this. It ended with him sparking a riot on Capitol Hill. And who would have thought that after all that, 4 years later, he'd be coming back in? It's hard to process. And, you know, for many people, it's a very difficult reality to process because, you know, for Trump, the reality of him means, you know, xenophobic rhetoric. He's already vowed to, you know, deport a number of immigrants on his first day in office. And, you know, there's a lot of to fear about him. And, you know, on this show, we spend so much time criticizing Democrats for ceding political space to people like Trump, basically by refusing to have principles themselves, allowing like a pretend populist to come in. And that's what we've tried to do here. And unfortunately, Democrats did not get the memo. And the result is 4 more years of Trump. That's what we're looking at right now.
And it's really, as much as Democrats and their defenders are trying to make it look like a huge defection to Donald Trump, as Yousef points out, it really is about Democrats not getting Biden voters to become Kamala voters. But Democrats and their media allies don't want to mention that because that would force them to look at their own faults. And instead, they just want to blame Jill Stein, Palestinian Americans, and as we explored in Thursday Throwdown, according to Al Sharpton and Joe Scarborough, the blame belongs to misogynist Black men and racist Latinos.
And I want to point out one more thing, which is that, you know, we're already seeing alarm yet again that Trump is going to use the government to go after his political opponents. And I want to say, you know, having covered Russiagate, having covered its sequel, Ukraine Gate, and then having mocked this obsession with people like Jack Smith is like the answer to Donald Trump. You know, liberal pundits who keep, you know, raising the alarm about, you know, Trump weaponizing government have to reckon, if they want credibility, they have to reckon with the fact that the government was actually used to frame Trump as a Russian agent. And it's since been used to bring all these legal cases against him and, you know, basically try to criminalize his candidacy. And there was all this, remember all the gloating about Jack Smith and the mugshot in Georgia and the conviction in New York? I think ultimately, you know, whatever you think about those cases, and some of those cases I think had merit, some of them didn't. But regardless, politically, I think ultimately that helped Trump. Just as Russiagate helped Trump, because when you frame someone as a Russian agent and you believe and you feel give people the idea that there's like a grand conspiracy with Moscow that Robert Mueller is going to uncover, when that collapses, as it inevitably did, that's a big gift to Trump. Just as it was a big gift to Trump to, I think, you know, let him claim once again that he's being persecuted by the government with all these legal cases, even though some of them I think did actually have merit. But remember classified documents, DocTalk, which we made fun of, the obsession over that and how that was, you know, we were told that was going to bring him down. It didn't bring him down. And now what's happening? Jack Smith is going to wind down his cases. He's done. So the main consequence there was just to give Trump tools to help fundraise and say, look at Jack Smith going after me, give me money. So Democrats need to, you know, think about, I think, how to appeal to working class people, obviously, how to maybe stop being supporters of genocide. Can they consider that? And also how to stop giving their opponents political gifts. Like Russiagate and like all these cases, if they want to have a chance at future victory.
Hear, hear. And make sure that you subscribe to usefulidiotspodcast.com so you can hear the full interview with Youssef, and also so you can get a pretty amazing Thursday throwdown, your midweek dose of media madness. There's so much media to make fun of this week, especially.
All right, that's the show. Our website again is usefulidiotspodcast.com. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next time.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. If you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at Useful Idiot Pod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.